Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's November 4th. I've got 21 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City, 24 degrees in Heber City under mostly sunny skies. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Wasatch Pack. Yeah, cold temperatures this morning. We're expecting highs to stay chilly today. Northerly flow is in place, about 37 in Park City with more sunshine. Clouds, though, tonight, after the sun goes down, we're expecting another weak system to brush by tonight into Tuesday evening. So overnight lows near 22. We could see a few snow showers overnight with a better chance tomorrow afternoon. No winter weather advisories with this system, not expecting enough moisture, but 1 to 2 inches or so of snowfall could or is possible in the Park City area with a high of just 33 tomorrow. Very cold overnight into Thursday, 15 degrees for the overnight low, and just 12 degrees Friday morning. Temperatures will be struggling to get above freezing as we get into Wednesday with a high of 35 on Thursday. Sorry, I jumped a day there. So Thursday morning, just 12 degrees and 17 degrees on Friday morning. Temperatures in the upper 30s on Friday with lots of sunshine after this storm system clears out on Wednesday morning as well. So sunny Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Should start to see more clouds on Sunday with another potential system early next week. Temperatures back in the mid-40s on Sunday as well. Heber looking at sunshine, 43 today. Overnight lows near 20. Plan on some snow showers overnight. Highs just near 39 tomorrow. Could see a half inch to an inch of moisture in Heber Valley. With temperatures in the teens as we get into Wednesday morning as well. Upper 30s for highs. Clouds on Wednesday morning, but otherwise clearing out in the afternoon. Should be a gorgeous latter half of the day on Wednesday. And then lots of sunshine Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Overnight lows will be in the teens. So cold starts with mid to low 40s for highs. Should bump up to the low 50s on Sunday with partly cloudy skies. Again, a slight chance of a passing shower on Sunday. Hopefully a better chance next week with another storm on the way.
Okay, Nate, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Sheriff Frank Smith along with Chief Deputy Casey Bates with an update on the department's budget request as well as some other law enforcement issues. Heber City Manager Matt Brower will be calling in, previewing tomorrow's City Council meeting, and Kimball Arts Center Executive Director Aldi Milliken is joined by their new Communications Director Alex Reginald. We'll be talking about some of their upcoming events. Taking a look now at some local news, Summit County has just released local council candidates' financial disclosures. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on how candidates spent their campaign funds leading up to tomorrow's general election.
Among all of Summit County's local candidates, council hopefuls Megan McKenna and Ari Ioannidis raised and spent the most, vying for council seat C. McKenna, a Democrat and Mountainland Community Housing Trust's housing advocate, raised more than $34,000 from 141 donors. Ioannidis, a Republican and board member at North Summit Fire and the Park City Institute, raised nearly $24,000 from 48 donors. Those numbers include the candidate's own personal contributions. McKenna has used about $340 of her own money, the price of filing to run for county council, and Ioannidis chipped in just over $13,000 to his campaign. Both candidates got money from their respective local political parties. McKenna also got $2,000 from the Communication Workers of America PAC. Most ski industry unions affiliate under the CWA, including at Park City Mountain. The Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association has publicly endorsed McKenna for seat C. Another large organization, the Park City Board of Realtors, gave $1,000 to both sides. Ioannidis has spent all the money he's received to date. McKenna still has about $5,000 in the bank. If she doesn't spend it by Tuesday's election, she'll not be allowed to pocket it. She can save it for another run in the future or donate it to another campaign. Only one council campaign donated to another. Hoytsville entrepreneur and Republican Tory Welch, running for seat A, gave Ioannidis $50. Welch is running to unseat 12-year incumbent Democrat Roger Armstrong. Welch has spent over $4,600, a third of it his own money, to do so. The Welch campaign is running a positive balance of about $500. Armstrong didn't fundraise. The only money he spent was on the filing fee to run. Fellow Democratic incumbent Tanya Hansen, who's unopposed for seat B, raised and spent about $640. Half was on filing, the other half on a website and flyers. Dems are also running unopposed for Summit County government down the ballot. The only expenses for County Sheriff Frank Smith and Treasurer Corey Forsling were their filing fees. Assessor Stephanie Paul spent a couple hundred dollars on tables and candy for her reelection bid. County Recorder hopeful Greg Walbach spent $400 on a website and email domain. Candidates will have to file another financial disclosure statement after the November 5th general election. The reports for all county candidates are available at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Sheriff's Office, I have Sheriff Frank Smith along with Chief Deputy Casey Bates. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with your budget, Sheriff. You're asking for four new deputies. How come so many?
Our patrol division hasn't changed since 2002 with the number of people. So with the increase in population, the increase in awareness of Park City since of our international ski campaigns, we just felt like it would keep the public safer to have more people on patrol. Visibility stops crime. So we're attempting to be more visible and be able to serve the public better.
What does that mean, though, in terms of, how busy are you?
We're busy. We're very busy. Some of it is proactive. The best way to stop the car burglaries and the home burglaries and the garage burglaries is be present in the community and be present in the subdivisions. So we've been busy. Our statistics are up. Our call volume is up extremely. And we just need the personnel.
Do you have those numbers by any chance? In terms of call volume?
So we went before the budget last week, and between 2002, which we wanted to use as an example because we hadn't had an increase in our patrol since then, so we took it back to 2002 until now. And there's the specific number I'm not aware of, but it was around 140% increase in our call volume, and that includes all of our call volume. So that was significant enough that we asked for that. We also are working with other divisions within Summit County. We're working with Jess Kirby. We're working with the county attorney's office. We're being pulled in a lot of directions within Summit County. So we wanted to make sure that we collaborate with everybody, and that's also part of this.
And I'm also a firm believer in community outreach. You know, our underserved community, there's crimes going on, but they're afraid to report it because they're afraid they'd be deported. So we have really vectored in on that, and our Spanish-speaking deputies have done tremendous work, you know, setting up, trying to get people driver's license, explain how you get insurance, things of that nature. But it also made us aware, look, there's a lot of crime there, but it's not being reported. So we want to serve those folks just as well as we do everyone else in the community.
So how easy is it going to be to find four deputies? Because I know that's not been easy in the past.
Well, and, you know, it always comes down to an issue of pay and culture. And, our pay is somewhere in the middle. So I have to be able to attract folks that are going to drive by five police stations or five sheriff's offices that pay more than we do. But so far, we've been very successful. And we have a great culture at the sheriff's office. And we allow people, to police our community. And I think people are attracted to the sheriff's office because of our community outreach. And, our theory that, 99.9% of the people you stop are good people in your neighbor. That 0.1%, that's a bad person. We'll arrest them, we'll be professionals, and we'll move on.
So it's not just four people, though. I mean, we're talking about four more vehicles, retirement.
Yes, ma'am.
Guns, equipment. I mean, what does it cost to equip a new deputy?
Well, it's about $6,500 just in uniform. Of course, we know the cost of a vehicle. Some of these new deputies that we've recruited in the past, we've had to put through the academy. So there are costs that are incurred. But, it's the community is worth it. And it's worth it in the sense that an active patrol unit keeps you safe. That person that may be driving through the community that's going to rob a 7-Eleven, if there's a patrol car there, that person's going to move on. So visibility is one of the keys to having a successful sheriff's office.
Yeah, so do they all have their own vehicles or do they share?
They all have their own vehicles, which again is part of the visibility. Because if they're driving home, that vehicle is still present, still visible, and still stops crime.
And speeders.
And speeders.
You're also asking for five new school resource officers. We got more schools than that in the county. So some have already been hired?
Yeah, we already had school resource officers in play, just not one in every school. You know, and with the new state mandates of having one in every school, there were three options. You could have a guardian, you could have a security officer or a deputy. How do I tell the parents at an elementary school, you have a guardian, but the middle school has a police officer? Our thought is we should cost share with the schools and provide a deputy at every school. We think that that will keep children safer. But on the other side of it, it gives children a view into the police officer, the sheriff's deputy is not a bad person. That person's my friend. And it opens the doors to great communication and an understanding of what law enforcement's about. And they shouldn't be afraid of them. So,
are these full-time jobs?
They are full-time jobs. Mm. So during the summer, I can augment the patrol division and the investigations division with the deputies not in the schools.
All right. And who pays them? I mean, are they county employees? Are they school district employees?
They're county employees. They will be county employees, and we have a contract that we have shared with the schools.
And the schools also pay for part of their vehicle. They pay for part of the deputy and part of the vehicle. So it's a joint venture, and the school districts have been amazing when it comes to sharing the costs and allowing us to move forward with this theory of putting a deputy in every school.
Well, we were a little ahead of the game because we had already been doing this with some of the schools. We did this with South Summit.
Right.
I know the Park City has done this. So we were a little ahead of the game in looking at the contract and knowing that it's a working method. If you ask the South Summit superintendent, our school resource officer that's there, that's the cost share, the parents know him, love him. The school knows him, loves him. It's just been a great resource to have there.
All right. So these resource officers, they too have gone through the academy?
Oh, we have several that are in schools already.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And then when do they have to be in school? I mean, you're short five, it sounds like. I mean, are you facing some kind of penalty here for not having Meyer?
No, go ahead.
So the mandate basically says, or the House bill says, that they have to be in the schools from 8 to 3. That's when they have to be there. And this has to be established by, I believe, the beginning of the next school year, that all of these have to be in place.
Okay. Any idea what this is costing taxpayers?
I don't have those numbers.
No, but I'll be glad to get them for you the next time we're on.
Okay.
It'll be significant because, you know, the taxpayers are not only paying the cost of the deputies, but with the school sharing, this is totally, funded by the taxpayer dollars.
Sure. All right. Also wanted to ask you, earlier this year, the sheriff's office was involved in a wrong-way driver collision. Did it end up being totaled?
Our vehicle was totaled, yes. And, these are difficult situations, and I admire the bravery of the deputy to be willing to drive their car into another car to stop it because they know what's coming. We've worked hard at trying to establish protocols to keep the deputy and the wrong way driver safe. You know, they're not always intoxicated, sometimes medical issues, sometimes it's just confusion. So we've worked on protocols and policies to try and keep the deputy safe. But the reality is, even with those protocols, we're going to shut the highway down at the exits, try and prevent anyone from coming till we can get the vehicle stopped. But the reality is, if we have to protect the public, it's a dangerous job, we'll do what we have to do to protect the public.
Yeah, you had mentioned before that you actually train for wrong-way drivers.
We do.
How do you do that without damaging more vehicles?
I kind of want to take it back a little bit. Wrong-way drivers are extremely dangerous for everyone. They're extremely dangerous for us responding. They're extremely dangerous for the public, extremely dangerous for the person that's driving wrong way. And when we get those calls into our communication center, we don't have any of the answers about this. That it begins with a lot of questions. And so, is this a medical event? Is this under the influence? So we have developed policies and adjusted our policies to train deputies to do this in the safest manner of responding to an intercepting wrong-way drivers. So we've included training with our emergency vehicle operations. We've included training, like the sheriff said, about getting in front of the driver and stopping traffic that's coming towards the driver so that maybe they can get to the exit. If that doesn't work, we have developed, and we're doing this with Park City, we're cooperating so that all agencies that are responding to this are going to respond in the same manner. And to your point of our officers and asking for more, we only have at the most four deputies on, and you know our demographic, you know what our roads look like, and the length of time that it takes to get there. So we are doing things to change, hopefully, the way, like you said, totaling the vehicles, the way that we're responding, and the way that we're dealing with these situations to mitigate the costs and the injuries.
Okay. We have reported on a number of drug busts, and I guess, is it just 'tis the season with the harvest coming out of California?
Is that what it is? And again, we're very proactive. You know, ironically, when you see a deputy, especially on the highway, we're more looking for human traffickers than we are drugs. But it seems like every stop that we make, you know, somehow drugs are involved.
Mm. And what about that? I mean, we reported on a suspected human smuggling case last week. This was a Utah Highway Patrol case. Mm-hmm. I mean, who are they pulling over? I mean, how would you know? I mean, is it are you targeting, you know, the Hispanic community or?
No. It's not targeting anyone. And to be candid, a lot of the people who are driving human traffickers aren't Hispanic. They're mules making money off the back of poor folks that are trying to pay to get across the border, to take a job in this country, because no matter what, it's still a better life. It's presence. You know, you are looking for indicators, which I really don't want to go into because they're investigative techniques. But it's not targeting. It's a Hispanic driver. We'll stop them. That's just never. A, it would never work, and B, we would never do that.
Yeah. So, are you able to talk to the family members though that were in the vehicle here? I mean, do they tell you? I mean,
most times, folks will talk to the deputies, but sometimes they won't. They're always afraid. You know, we're in an awkward and tough position because they're always afraid that we're going to take them back to the border and deport them. So it's pretty closed community when it comes to these things.
What does happen to this family of three last week?
I'm not even aware of the case that the patrol made. This is a situation where we're worried about the safety of the people in that vehicle, especially if it's young girls. Everyone knows all the horror stories. We will treat them compassionately, but we have to obey the law.
Yeah, so do you know of cases, though, where, where we're seeing that happen here in Summit County, where we know that people have been brought over the border, and then what, they've got to pay off their smuggler?
We met with a coalition of folks about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that's what we discussed. It was local people that live here, people that had knowledge of this, mostly working in, you know, the service type industries, and it's something that we are looking at.
Well, and this is where our community outreach program comes in, is we have our community outreach program that is they're becoming integrated, and they're willing to talk to our community outreach deputies that are there. And so we're going to get, as he said, we talked to them last week, and we're going to use our community outreach people to help talk to those people to bring more awareness to us.
Okay, because the way I heard it explained was basically, you know, that they've got a fee to pay off. Correct. And so they work, and, you know, the coyote or whoever comes over, you know, every 2 weeks to collect payment.
That's what we were told, something at least close to that. Mm. And, you know, if we have people cooperating with us, we are looking to incarcerate the folks who are preying on these people that just want to work hard.
Moving on, there's a lot of concern by Salt Lake media about the Salt Lake City Police Department's plan to encrypt their public safety radio communication. What does that mean, that we won't be able to listen to dispatcher radio anymore?
So okay, let's go back. So we're all cutting over to this P25. It's called a P25 cutover, and ours is actually happening tomorrow and Wednesday. And what is happening is we're moving from an 800 megahertz system to a 700 megahertz system. And within that system, it is my understanding that you could ask for some of your channels to be encrypted. As to our knowledge, we have not asked for any of our channels to be encrypted. I don't know what Salt Lake is doing or if they have asked for those things, but to my knowledge, we have not asked for any of those to happen.
Okay, because I think there's some concern, you know, by encrypting the feed, it sharply limits the media's critical role of promptly notifying the public about immediate safety concerns and bringing more accountability.
Absolutely.
I can tell you, I have not asked for our radios to be encrypted.
Okay, and I guess, so why is that a good thing, though, to encrypt it for law enforcement, then?
Well, because if, say, you're going on a drug raid, you don't want to be on the radio announcing where you're going. There are benefits to encryption because it's more secure. But I struggle with, we can do that in a manner that we can still be safe. And as long as the media hears what we're saying on the radio, I think it's good for the community. It's definitely good for the media. And I think it keeps police departments, sheriff's departments honest.
Yeah, I think the only reason that you would encrypt a channel is for officer safety purposes.
Right.
If you are going into something and the element of surprise is no longer there if you haven't encrypted a channel that you're working on.
Okay. And I wanted to ask about this, ballot box safety. Is that the sheriff's job to enforce, to make sure that our ballot box are safe?
It is.
Mm-hmm. And
it is.
So how we know, we heard, of course, about the ones in Washington State getting, you know,
firebombed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So could that happen here?
I mean, it could happen anywhere. We have cameras and security and surveillance up on all of those boxes. It's become a daily part of our patrol. And we're doing everything we can to keep it safe because, honestly, for someone that's served this country for 40 years, I think it's the most sacred thing that a nation can do, have a fair and honest election.
Yeah, so do our boxes then have that retardant in? So in case they were firebombed, they wouldn't burn? Or?
It's my understanding that all ballot boxes have that retardant in them.
Okay. I mean, I just, looking at the visuals from those in Washington, and it was like burning ballots were coming out. So
yeah, I saw
they were
same.
Destroyed. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that whatever fuel they threw in there to accelerate that, you know, it caught some things on fire. But the majority of it, it looked charred, but it seemed like they pulled a lot of ballots still out that hadn't been burned. So.
All right. And then more scams to report?
Oh, my goodness. It seems like it gets worse, especially around the holidays. But it's the same thing, calling, putting people, you know, in a position where they think there's going to be a fine and immediately be arrested and send funds. The newest one that came out was through VRBO. Someone sent a deposit to a invalid address and lost the deposit. But, yes, the scams are prevalent. Remember, please, we will never call you and ask for money. We will either send you certified mail or show up. If someone calls you, hang up.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention? Okay.
Thank
Casey
you.
Casey Bates, Frank Smith, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Well, Election Day is tomorrow, and Wasatch County is sharing the safeguards in place to ensure the integrity of this election. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Wasatch County Clerk Auditor Joey Granger and her team have a busy schedule. The clerk's responsibilities include maintaining voter rolls, providing, collecting, and securing ballots, counting votes, and publishing election results. Granger says there are numerous safeguards in place to ensure election integrity.
All ballots have to be under camera security and with two people.
Her office collects mail-in ballots directly from the local post office.
We go and we collect from them directly. So the ballots don't ever leave the post office with a postmaster. They're not, you know, roaming around town in somebody else's vehicle.
Once the ballots reach the county government building, they're counted twice and logged in the tracking system. Then they're safely locked away until judges come to verify the signatures. About 25,000 voters are registered in the county. So far, Granger says her office has processed about 8,500 ballots. That means the signatures have been verified by both a machine and at least one judge, and the ballots are ready to be counted. If a voter's signature isn't verified, the clerk's office contacts that person to confirm their vote. Granger says her office will notify voters once their ballots have been received. That information only goes out once each ballot's signature is verified. Residents voting by mail can check the progress of their ballots online. Mail-in ballots must be postmarked no later than Monday, November 4th to be counted. Voters can return their ballots in person at any drop box in Wasatch County until 8 p.m. Tuesday. A list of ballot drop-off locations is available at kpcw.org. On Election Day, residents can vote in person at the Wasatch County Senior Citizen Center from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Granger says her goal is to publish partial election results around 9 p.m. Tuesday. Information on candidates is compiled in KPCW's Wasatch Back Voter Guide, available at kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, the Heber City Council meets tomorrow in work session starting at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview, I have City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. So we've got an hour-long discussion and work session about airport rates and charges. It sounds like those need to go up in order to build a capital fund to implement the airport master plan. How much are we talking about?
That's absolutely correct. We recently completed the airport master plan, and that plan's identified a large number of capital improvements that have to be done. Our portion of those improvements is about $4 million that we have to raise over a 20-year period. So the rates and fees study that council will talk about at length tomorrow is being discussed in order to make sure that the rates and fees are set at a level to make sure that we can meet our obligations.
So at least $1.8 million apparently is needed for the next 5 years. Can the airport authority just bond on expected revenues?
We don't have an airport authority. It would be up to the city council, and we hope to use what's called the pay-as-you-go, using cash essentially for these improvements. And that's why this discussion tomorrow night is so important, to make sure we set these rates at a level that will be sufficient to raise the cash needed to fund our proportionate share of these capital improvements.
Okay, so who pays for the fees? Only airport users?
Because we are an airport that receives FAA money, the FAA will fund typically about 90% of the capital improvements. UDOT, Aeronautics, will fund another 5%, and the city's on the hook for the last 5%. So we are obligated to raise $4 million, which equals the 5% obligation that we have.
All right, so there are a number of options that would increase everything from landing fees to fuel fees and increasing hangar rental rates. What's the city recommending?
Staff is recommending that we look at a number of fee increases, not any one fee in particular, but a number of fees, such as landing fees, such as apron fee increases, such as hangar rental increases, land lease increases. So we're trying to make sure that we use a very diversified sources of revenue and not rely upon one or two sources of revenue at the airport.
All right. Also, in work session is a discussion on the National Historic District and Historic Building Survey. Why was this done?
So it hasn't been done yet. Former Councilwoman Rachel Kaler is trying to influence the City Council to look at creating a historic area, a historic district in the downtown. So she'll be coming before the City Council tomorrow evening to discuss her strategy for creating that very district. She's hoping that the district will help maintain the downtown, particularly the residential districts on both sides of Highway 40, and hoping that this will be a grassroots effort where the homeowners, property owners themselves will want to come forward and support this type of initiative.
Okay, so it sounds like there may be plans to create a local historic district, or we're not even that far?
Not that far yet. Mm-hmm. I think tomorrow night is the first significant discussion the council will have on this notion of creating a historic district. Of course, creating the district's the easy part, understanding what type of architectural controls is the hard part. And so this is the first step in the discussion that we'll have, and looking forward to hear more of what former Councilwoman Cato have to say.
Okay. It sounds like there may be some grant money involved, but it would be a 50-50 split. Can you talk to us what that could be used for?
It's my understanding that there is a grant opportunity that would provide for at least 50% of the cost. And I think the request tomorrow night is, would the city be willing to match the other 50%? And of course, that request will have to be made tomorrow night. We'll see what my city council says.
All right. How's that downtown infrastructure replacement project going? I know you're going to get an update on that.
We are in year 3 of 4. We have one more year to go. This season is winding down quickly as the temperatures start to drop. The work becomes slower and slower and less efficient. And so we're trying to wrap up the work that we have underway now and look to kick off the work for season 4 early next spring.
So did you find the money you need to finish the project?
We did. We were able to bond for additional resources. This project includes replacing water lines, sewer lines, storm drain lines. Some of these lines, as you know, are upwards to 80, 85 years of age. And because of the length of this project being 4 years, we've seen 40-year high inflationary increases, which have had significant impacts upon the cost of the project. So yes, we've been able to bond to cover the inflationary increases and be able to complete the project next year on schedule.
Okay. And do we have other old lines needing to be replaced going forward?
So that's a great point. This project focuses entirely on the east side of town. This is the area east of Highway 40 to about 5th East. We still have the west side to do, going from Highway 40 to about 6th West. And so that will have to be planned and programmed in future years. We just need to figure out how to finish our first phase, which is the east side, and then we'll worry about coming back and doing the west side sometime in the future.
Okay. Wanted to talk briefly about the recent unveiling of plans for the downtown park. Consultant Roger Brooks promised this is going to be the most awesome square in the United States. That's quite a statement.
I like bold. I like enthusiasm. Nothing great can happen without enthusiasm. Roger Brooks is an urban planner, one of the best urban planners, to be quite frank with you. He was placed under contract by the chamber to look at our park to see how we can leverage the park to bring about greater economic opportunities in the downtown. And he's presented a couple of weeks ago a plan for the park, which would allow us to program upwards to 250 days a year of events and activities. And we hope that type of programming would capture the interest of the private sector who might be willing to redevelop some of the older, more tired areas of our downtown.
So where's the location of this? Where the city, current city park is?
That is correct. It's the full block. That's our main city park. That sits between Highway 40 and 1 West, 2nd South and 3rd South. That is correct.
All right. And when you say 250 days a year, what about parking? Or is this only going to be kind of a walkable area?
Parking is a big part of the equation. Roger is also under contract to generate some recommendations regarding how we'll deal with parking. Heber City is looking at acquiring several parcels in the downtown to provide for additional surface parking opportunities. And we see this issue play out every summer with the Heber Market on Main. It has come to be a very successful Thursday evening market. And we have people that are literally parking upwards to a mile away that walk their way into the park to experience what we have programmed. So yes, parking is an issue, and Roger Brooks, as part of his scope of work, is to provide us some recommendations on how to handle that.
All right. And I think I heard that it was about a $17 million price tag. And I question, you know, it's like we haven't even come up with funding to replace the old deteriorating infrastructure on the west side of town. Why would we put, you know, millions of dollars into a park?
Well, understand that the two projects are very different and have very different funding sources. The park would be funded through impact fees that are generated through new development. It would be funded through tax increment financing that we're trying to get approved with the county and the school district. And it also be funded through our cap tax, which is approved by our residents 2 years ago as part of a referendum initiative. And so obviously we are not going to be able to do this overnight. We're going to have to phase it. We'll have to make sure that we put into place those phases that can generate the greatest return on investment. and understand this is an investment that will generate a return on our downtown. And that's really why we're focusing on this initiative so intently, is that we believe once this investment is made that it will generate additional tax money far beyond the $17 million.
Okay. And this is all part of the Envision Central Heber plan?
Correct.
Yeah, so how's that? That's just one of many parts of that plan, yeah?
That is correct. For your listeners, Envision Central Heber is an initiative that focuses on three areas, but the one we're focused on right now in this conversation is our Main Street area. We have a downtown that has a lot of older development, that's tired, that's in many cases over 100 years of age. And we're hoping to transition downtown from what it is now, which is a pass-through, into a destination where people are coming downtown Heber for the dining opportunities, for the shopping opportunities, and of course the entertainment opportunities.
All right, and how soon could construction start on this?
Well, phase one is actually under construction as we speak. This is the main stage located on the north end of the park and the transformation of Second South into a festival street. We're hoping that the contract will have phase one completed by December 1st of this year.
All right. And then going forward, it's as you have money that you'll move ahead. Would portions of the park then get closed as you kind of move forward with the phasing?
Yeah, so a couple things have to happen. One is the city council has to adopt the proposed plan from Roger Brooks as the master plan for the park. Once that happens, we'll then look at phasing the project and then, of course, taking on the phases once we have the appropriate monies to do so.
Okay, so at this point, the plan has not been adopted. Is that what I heard?
That is correct.
Okay, when do you think that'll happen?
I hope to do it before year end, speaking with the contractor over the weekend, looking to come in before the city council, maybe the first meeting in December to finish that conversation.
Okay. Anything else, Matt, you wanted to mention?
Just that we have our old-fashioned Christmas event coming up on December 6th. This is Friday, December 6th. This is always a wonderful Hallmark event in our community, and certainly love to invite your listeners to come.
Okay. Sure. Appreciate your time. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, the Kimball Arts Center has a number of upcoming events, and in the studio with a preview, I have Executive Director Aldi Milliken, who is joined by his new Communications Director, Alex Reginald. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Aldi, previously you've been going out of house, I think, for your marketing needs. Did you decide just to kind of commit and get a full-time in-house staff member?
Yeah, this was a planned move for us. Misha Ross was a consultant for a number of years, and she'd done an amazing job and set the platform for Alex to succeed and the Kimball to succeed. So this was a planned move.
Okay. Alex, tell us a little about yourself.
Hi. Well, I just joined the team October 7th. Was in Colorado for the last 3 years, but happy to be back in Utah. I've been here on and off since 2017. And I'm super excited to jump on board with the Art Center and definitely have big shoes to fill. Misha is still definitely a friend to the Art Center and is still around. So luckily we've got her help and advice. But I'm super excited to be on board.
Okay, well, congratulations. Let's see, you've got an event happening this Thursday, November 7th, Art on the Screen. Is this a first with Park City Film that you've done?
It's the first in a while. I mean, we've done some collaborations with them, but this is the first sort of really formal one that I've actually done. And I'll be presenting the work of Carl Handel that sort of will set off a conversation with a couple of films that we'll be screening. So it's actually a really exciting partnership. We're looking for really authentic ways to collaborate through the content of the work. So I'll show slides from from our exhibition that will then sort of trigger conversations that will happen with the two other films that we're showing.
Okay, so this is happening, as I mentioned, Thursday the 7th at Jim Santee Auditorium.
Exactly, yep. And we'll be showing Wild Hogs and Saffron, a work by Andy Sarignani, and also Planet Walker. They're both documentaries. They're both about about masculinity, about relationships, about vulnerability, friendship. These are all themes that Carl has in our exhibition.
Okay. And how did you find these two films?
We worked through Katie Wang and their team. She suggested these pieces. I mean, she came and we talked about the exhibition. We talked about our values and about sort of some of the themes that we wanted to share. And then she went back and reviewed a lot of. And she has, I mean, obviously massive amounts of resources, an incredible sort of film scholar, and so she was able to compile a selection of films that we then reviewed. And then decided on these two, and they're really different. It'll be a really packed program, and I think really interesting for people to sort of try to piece together a lot of the themes and a lot of the complications of humanity, complications of maleness and masculinity that has been sort of been defined by other sources. And I think we're kind of taking ownership over some of these themes and then sharing it with the public.
Okay, it is free and starts at what, 7?
Starts at 7 o'clock. They always start at 7. Katie reminded me. At the library, come and be and participate. Come and be prepared to sort of share your ideas. Hopefully, the artwork will trigger some thinking. And then, of course, Carl's coming back next week, and so that's the sort of the lead-in to his own talk about his work.
Okay, so after the two films and your kind of presentation.
Yeah, that's on the 7th, and then, I'm sorry, that's on the...
Are you going to do a panel discussion, or is it just, it's just part of...
With the work...
This Thursday.
It'll be more, I think Katie and I, I'll present the slides, and then we'll look at the films, and then afterwards, Katie and I will sort of lead the group through conversations.
All right, and then as you mentioned, a week from Thursday, the 14th,
right.
Carl Handel actually will be in town.
He will be back in town for about 3 or 4 days. Oh, he had a great time in Park City when he was last here. We obviously had to produce this show. It took about 10 days for him to hang the work. This is a very generous exhibition. There's a lot of artworks in it, and I think it's always extraordinary to have the artist talk through what is really 20 years of artwork that he's created, and just both looking at process, looking at the themes that he's compiled, and there's nothing better than the source. I mean, that's what the Kimball is all about, right? So we like to elevate the voices of artists, and he is someone special. I think a lot of artists in our community should really come and view and talk to and engage with. He's very approachable, I think it's going to be a great evening.
Okay, that will be at the Kimball. What time?
That will be at 6:30 at the Kimball, and it will be free as well. We expect a lot of people to come, and so I don't know. There's no ending time on that. I think we'll start at 6:30 and just go as long as we want, as need. The last time we did a talk with this work, it was an hour and a half. People just didn't want to go. They wanted more information. They wanted to check out the artwork. They couldn't believe that a pencil made these incredible images. And so it was quite a special evening.
And that's all of them, pencil on paper.
Yeah, he actually uses a ballpoint pen or a Sharpie on some of the pieces. So, you know, it's still very much analog. It's slow. It's very methodical, very intentional, and really dynamic. And almost a lot of the works, if you've seen it, I think they look a lot like photographs, but they're not photographs when you get closer.
Yeah, and so will people be seated, or are we walking around the gallery?
We will do both. I think it's nice to have seats for people. And then what we did before, we'll walk around. We have chairs that people can carry and move around. I think it's always better to talk about a work. I mean, if you're talking about reflection or introspection, and you know, you've got this incredible artwork in front of you, you want to really like dig into it a little bit. So I think moving around and looking at the works is sort of the way to go.
And it's kind of weird. I mean, because there's art in the corners too. You just kind of like pass by.
Well, we don't use the word weird. we would say intentionally. It's an artist-driven exhibition. It's not a formal show that you'd find in a museum in any other parts of the world, right? It's created by an artist in collaboration with the institution, and you know, when we were talking with Gretchen Dietrich, the director of the Utah Museum of Fine Arts, she was getting nervous about how the works were close to corners and almost next to the floor or on the ceiling. And you know, the Kimball can elaborate on the artistic process and have artists drive the conversation instead of an institution sort of formalize the work. So that's one of the special things that we offer. And Carl's pushed us. And if you look at museum shows around the world that are driven by artists, you'll find sort of the hanging or the sort of the unformality of the work in this way.
Okay. Alex, you want to run through a couple of the other events that you got coming up?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot going on right now. Our winter weekly classes just opened up. There's a lot of great stuff on offer. So right now, registration is open for members of the Arts Center. And then on November 8th, they'll be open to the public. But this is also a great time to become a member and support Kimball Arts Center. And like I said, there's a bunch of really great stuff on offer. We've got New Year's Eve for kids coming up on the 31st, ceramics drop-ins, kid-friendly holiday drop-ins. So it's a really great time to kind of get involved with the Arts Center and take some awesome classes and become a member if you're not already. And then this current exhibition that we're doing the artist talk for will close on the 1st. So this is kind of the last month to come in and see it. And it is really, really special. So, you know, we've got another one around the corner, of course, but this one is a great one to come see if you're able to this month.
Yeah. How many classes, Aldi, do you do?
Oh, my goodness. The last count, I think, was 360 a year. I mean, that doesn't... Those are just offerings, so each class could be several weeks. So we're probably over 500 classes a year, individual classes, probably even a lot more. But yeah, over 360.
Yeah, so they're popular.
They're very popular, and actually they sell out, they're almost all fully booked. And we are offering more and more as time goes on, but we're pretty much at capacity in our current building. Obviously, we also teach all the elementary school classes and with our EVA program, and then we do a lot of outreach as well. So we are a full place. I think 2023, we had 86,000 individual art experiences for our public. Pretty exciting.
Okay. Wanted to also ask about the Park City Council recently got a recap from you on the Kimball Arts Festival. So what was your take? Are you happy with this year's event?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we're trying to continue to communicate to the council and to our public is the sort of the value of the arts, sort of that the impact that we provide for the Arts Fest. And I think a lot of people see the 3-day event and they see 30,000 people on Main Street, you know, over 10,000 locals on Locals Night, and there's all that enthusiasm. What they don't see is the 300 volunteers and the masses amounts of people that put this on around the year and all the artists that submit, the 1,200 artists that submit their proposals in March. So there's just so many activities that happen, and it's hard to convey that in numbers because we can't. We know that people come to Main Street and they buy an ice cream cone or they have a pizza or they shop on Main Street, and we know that people are coming to Main Street. What we don't know is that true economic impact. So we use two different numbers. We use sales figures from the Utah Tax Authority, so that's about $2 million of art sales and food sales through the festival. And then we have indirect costs, and not to get in the weeds of all this sort of impact stuff, but those indirect costs are really high. And so we're all trying to land on what those true numbers are.
Okay. Also, during a recent Planning Commission meeting about the expansion, I think it's of the Boneyard, yeah?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Mark Fisher had mentioned, he's the owner of the property, that your lease is set to expire early next year. He's calling it a conundrum. I mean, I know you're tracking this, but
yeah,
he wants the space. You've got a good deal, but it sounds like you may have outstayed your welcome. So
I wouldn't quite call it like that. Mark Fisher and his team have been really supportive of the Kimball Arts Center. Have been fantastic. Landlords, donors, I mean, the family has been incredible and supportive of us, and we have a great relationship. I think the conundrum is, you know, if you go back to 2017, we made an agreement with the city for a property on 1401 Kearns. The city came to us and said, hey, we have a great idea. We don't want to make this cultural district. They talked to Sundance, they talked to the Kimball, and we were in a building at that time. And so to kind of further the conversation, Mark Fisher... And I've looked at the 2017 minutes of those meetings now. Mark Fisher sold the property to the city with the specific interest of making a culture district. And I think what we need to continue to remind ourselves was that was sort of a deal at the time. And we acted in good faith to continue that partnership with the city. And we want to maintain that relationship to the city. And we want to see this culture district through. So... The expressed intent always was to make that culture district. That's taken a lot longer than we all thought. Mark has been caught up in the middle of that with the building because we needed a temporary location in the meantime. But it still goes back to this shared desire to build a culture district or cultural hub or a cultural center, something for locals that includes the Kimball Arts Center.
Well, I certainly don't want to imply that Mark is going to kick you out.
But I do.
I mean, it's like you're going to need to extend your lease by, what, another 5 years?
We're hoping not that long. I mean, if the city is moving quickly on this with the RFP, but there, I think decisions have to be made. Decisions have to be elevated. We have to, we need support from our community. We need support from our council members. We need to make this project happen.
Okay. Aldi, Alex, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.